Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, for concern the soccer team, I think that's probably the only time where I would have to choose the astronomy team over the condensed matter team. But at Carnegie, things are mixed up anyway. So the boundaries are very ill-defined, and then so you get exposed to lots of problems that you have never heard of, and sometimes you can help, sometimes. The topic of today's talk will basically be devoted to computer simulations applied to planetary problems. And I learned all the techniques as a condensed matter physicist and then branched out to help solve problems in astrophysics. I work at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, a little bit northwest of the White House, close to Bethesda. We are relatively small. We have two departments on this campus. There's some up in Stanford also. And one is called the Geophysical Laboratory, which deals with high-pressure experiments primarily to study materials exposed to high pressure as they occur in the Earth. And the typical experiment is done using diamond anvil cells. So what they basically take, they take two diamonds and put a material in the middle, squeeze real hard, and then can generate pressures of 300 gigapascals, which is comparable to the center of the Earth, and then can study the transformation that occur. We're using different spectroscopic methods, and Russ Hemley and Dave Mao are one of the main drivers of this method. The other department, which is of equal interest to me, is the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, where now a lot of astronomy is done. I think Vera Rubin is here, and Paul Butler, for example. And besides the astronomy, they're also doing a lot of isotope geochemistry. We're interested in astrobiology also. So Carnegie is relatively small, but very diverse. So you get exposed to quite a few subjects. So if you ever come to talk to us, you basically have to give a colloquium without any acronyms. Astronomers are usually the worst people for acronyms because they never explain these things. So I think I will try to do my best not to expose you to too many high-pressure physics acronyms. So one of them we're going to use is PIMC, which is Path Integral Monte Carlo, which is one of the techniques I'm using to study dense fluids. And I'm combining this with density functional calculations, which is another technique which I'm sort of presenting. There's a postdoc who did a lot of work on this project, and there's a collaboration with Dalhousie University we've been doing. Once we calculated the properties of this fluid, he basically goes to someone who actually has a lot of expertise in modeling the interior of planets. And in this particular case, we work with Bill Hubbard at Arizona and with Dave Stevenson at Caltech. And the work is supported by NASA, by NSF, and by a small grant from the Carnegie Institution of Canada. And why is there so much interest in extrasolar planets? The field really took off by great improvements in the radial velocity measurements, where you can detect the planet, which you cannot see directly, but you basically see that the star wobbles back and forth as the planet, which you cannot detect directly, and the star sort of move around this common center of mass, and you have a Doppler shift in the light that's being given off. So Paul Butler and Jeff Marcy, so they had a project where they actually tried to detect this wobble, and they had sort of expected to look for something like Jupiter, which would take like 12 years. So you would look for light curves that go up and down in frequency over a period of 12 years. So you would take a spectra and then store it on this hard drive and come back a year later and repeat the experiment. And he's done this a couple of years when the first planet was actually detected by a group in Switzerland. And the big surprise was that it was real. So you see this oscillation to the graphs. And it orbits the star in 4 days. So the team at Carnegie and Berkeley could go back to their data hard drive and reanalyze all the data what he had. And had a number of planets already sitting on a hard drive waiting to discover. Just basically the time frame was slightly off. So since then, the field has taken off, and we have like 200 planets detected with this technique. And we have like, I thought before I left on this trip, it's 14 transiting planets. They were detected basically found by the planet going in front of the star, and you see a little dip in the brightness. But I learned on the trip actually we have 20 at the moment. So we have like two techniques, and this one has the advantage it gives us, in addition to the mass, it also gives us the radius of the planet, so we can say something about the composition while we cannot say anything at this point. Most of those are sort of so-called heavy Jupiters, and I will say that a little bit more in a moment. Yes, most of those planets are relatively heavy. If you plot them as a function of Jupiter masses, then you find a maximum of about 13. Beyond that, it would not be considered a planet anymore. It would have burned hydrogen or deuterium at some point. And you have this long distribution where you have most of the planet are sort of at Jupiter size or less. And there's a big bias in here because these things are the easiest ones you can detect. If you plot planetary mass as a function of semi-major axis, all these heavy objects have a bigger pull on the star. There's a bigger frequency shift, and therefore you find them more easily. So if you want to find something like Earth in these units here, 1 and 1, then you basically have a problem because this gravitational pull is a lot less. You're about two orders of magnitude away. And also, you're not, many of these lighter planets are actually found at very, very small orbits because they're just easier to find. So we actually, in the next 5 years, I'm sure we find a planet that's comparable to Earth. But at the moment, we're a little bit away from it. So the one of the sort of confirmed addition that was made is something like it's like 7 Earth masses. And the only way it was discovered and was basically because it's on a very small orbit. It's very so the planet is very hot. So there's another work recently published where they say they have a planet in the habitable zone. I think we find more of these things, and the field will be growing, and we need a bigger need for characterizing these planets. And that's one of the things we're working on at the moment. So the other thing that we can mention about these techniques is a secondary eclipse. So the primary transit planet, when it goes in front of the star, blocks some of the starlight, and then you can estimate its radius. What's also very interesting is if the star, the planet actually vanishes behind the star, you can sort of take a difference in the two spectra. One, the planet is there, and one, the planet is hidden. And you can say something about the missing light from the planet, and in principle, can say something about of the composition of the planet. So that's currently being done, and we will hopefully say something about the sort of the envelope, at least, of those planets in the future. So there's a third technique I would like to mention here. The first time I heard about it, that gravitational lensing experiments could be used to detect planets, I thought it's unbelievable. I thought that's, to me, that was something that would occasionally happen when light would be bent. That was far from being useful for anything. So what it is, there were four planets were discovered with gravitational lensing. So the first thing you have to understand is how does that work? So you have the observatory is sort of here, and the sort of time goes from the left to the right. And you have a planet in the middle that has a star in the middle that has a planet. So the lens is the star in the middle that has the planet acts as the lens of the gravitational lensing effect. So that's the first thing. So we have a background star that does nothing else than providing a source of light that then gets bent. So the planet and the lensing star in the middle will cause this light to bend. So what happens in the course of the time when this the lensing planet sort of goes in the line of sight, then sort of for a short moment of time, you basically see one, two images, one to the left and one to the right, and you would basically see this increase in light curve. So that's the traditional lensing effect. There's no planet involved at this point. So when the planet sort of plays it, this is like you're looking at the sun and you have a magnifying glass. Well, if you look at the sun, eventually it's going to hit you, right? So you have a gigantic caustic effect that leads to these signatures when the planet actually causes, adds to a third image just because it's right in the exact spot where it helps with the lensing effect. And they can sort of model the system and then can say something about the planet. So four planets have been detected. The problem is it's hard to follow up. There's mostly the far away, the isolated events. And we know the planets are there, we model the system, but then we have to wait an unspecified amount of time, maybe never, that we see the next lensing event. I think that's actually how they look. I think I think it is, and I have to say I didn't really draw this myself. I just been this explained to me as well. I'm the theorist here, so anything you quiz me on the observations, I do my best. But yes, I think that's actually how they look like. Yeah. Yeah, so here I can say a few more things about this problem here. So what's our contribution? We're condensed matter people. We study materials that are condensed and therefore at relatively high densities. And this is sort of the phase diagram of hydrogen. And you have temperature here and you have density at the x-axis. And if you have a typical stellar object like the sun, it's sort of 10,000 degrees on the surface, and then you follow an isentrope and you can characterize its interior just by having an equation of state. So for Jupiter, we want to do the same thing with sort of 130 Kelvin on the surface, and then we sort of go towards the interior. So on the outside, Jupiter is in a molecular envelope. If you were then to heat up hydrogen, the molecules would break and into atoms, and if you heat it up further, the electrons would be ionized, and you have a typical plasma of free particles. I will show you two methods. One of them is Parabolic Monte Carlo that can sort of cover a good regime of this phase diagram. And if you increase the density, you know what's known in Jupiter, you go from a molecular envelope to a metallic fluid. And that's basically a density effect, where you basically, the system becomes so dense that the molecular orbitals that provide the binding in the hydrogen molecules don't have space anymore. And the system goes to a new preferred state where the electrons delocalize, and then there's no binding anymore. And as a result of this delocalization, you have hydrogen turns metallic. It's a good electric conductor, and therefore it provides the magnetic field. So we have evidence for this, that this is actually happening in Jupiter. So there's no question. The question is how we characterize this transition best. So with the simulation that we're doing, we saw it's nice to go back to the grandfathers of quantum mechanics, and they already pointed out that all the fundamental laws necessary for the mathematical treatment of large part of physics and the whole of chemistry are all completely known. And the difficulty only lies in the fact that the laws lead to equations that are too complex to be solved. So this is largely true today. 75 years later, this is actually still a true statement. The only thing we can qualify, but this is one word we should be added here, and that's basically about too complex to be solved exactly. So basically what I'm trying to say here today is that we have good approximations that will lead to a good description of materials. And there's constantly people like Chris Delaunay in the physics, in the material science department now, who actually tries to come up with better ways of characterizing materials. And I will sort of describe this in a little bit. Today I'm going to show some results from this Parabolic Monte Carlo technique, which allows me to characterize the high temperature part of this phase diagram. The method is very efficient if you treat systems where electronic excitations are important. And at low temperature, this is not an efficient way of doing things, and there we basically refer to a ground state method, which I'm using density functional theory, which is sort of has been developed in the 60s and 70s, and it's now the workhorse for many material science applications. And Chris Delaunay's work tries to go beyond this. So we try still using density functional calculations. And the way it works is basically you have classical nuclei, which are depicted by this sphere here. And then you solve the electronic problem. You try to solve the orbitals. So when you learned chemistry, you know, a methane molecule or water molecule, you had the nuclei somewhere, and then the orbitals that you're familiar with. We are deriving these orbitals in a good approximation in real time. This gives us forces, and we use classical equations of motions, and F equals ma, and then we move the nuclei a little bit, we rederive those orbitals, and we have forces again, and we follow the classical trajectories of these nuclei derived from quantum mechanical forces. And that gives us a description for the lower part of the phase diagram. So in two regimes, we don't have to run these heavy calculations. So these calculations are, we run them in many processors, we run them over weeks on supercomputers to derive the best possible answer. At very low density, you can use analytical techniques. The same is true for very, very high temperatures. They also work. And also in extreme densities, they also work again. So there you have to gauge our calculation results. Eventually, they should converge to these analytical methods. So before computer simulations, these analytical techniques, these sort of analytical or chemical models, were used to cover the entire phase space. But they don't work very well where the systems are highly correlated and the density is very high. And the improvements for the model for Jupiter mainly come from more accurate simulations that I'm going to present now. What we know about Jupiter is that it's mainly characterized on the surface. We had the Galileo probe that actually went inside and could measure the composition in situ. We know it's basically 74% hydrogen, 23% helium, and then we have another bunch of elements in different concentrations that the astronomers sort of all lumped together as heavy Z. And sort of otherwise, we expect we have a molecular envelope, a large metallic part, and there's supposedly a rocky core that was there to begin with when the planet formed, and that the size of this core is subject of significant debate at the moment. So given this overall structure, Christian Guyot in Nice, he's one of the experts who works with Dave Stevenson and also Didier Sumon, and they basically construct a model for the interior. In principle, you need three things to construct the best possible model. First of all, an equation of state. That's where I come in, or previous models come in. So you start out with a surface temperature that you know. You have an equation of state that gives you guidance, and you construct a curve of constant entropy because the system is fully convective. And in principle, therefore, you know when you start here, you know how the interior looks like. So in addition, you add what you know about the surface composition, and you add one more ingredient. It's known as the gravitational moments that are inferred from flyby trajectories. So if the planet would not be rotating, there would be no information. But the planet is a rapid rotor, and as a result, there is some oblateness, and it's not a perfect sphere anymore. As a result, you can actually say something about the density distribution on the inside, which is typically characterized as gravitational moments. And all these three things were put together by a model by Christian Guyot and others, and they have published sort of different models for the interior. And there are two parameters that could sort of not fully be constrained. There's the core mass, and there's the amount of heavy Z elements. How many ices and other things should be in there? And in particular, if they took an equation of state, let's say they took the linear mixing model by a fellow named Marvin Ross, they would predict, in order to make consistent with all the other things that we have, you take his equation of state, and then there should be a core mass of about seven sort of Earth masses here, and so there should be this amount of heavy elements. So then there is the Sumong-Chapier equation of state, which has been applied to many, many astrophysical objects. And there's also the sesame equation. Sesame is preferred by many people because it agrees relatively well with shock experiments, which I'll describe at the end of the talk. And if you follow this prediction, then you can say there is no rocky core in Jupiter. So if there is no rocky core inside, there's a big problem to explain how the planet came there to begin with. So the standard scenario is core accretion. You have planetesimal that collide beginning of the solar system, you have collisions, some of them stick, and slowly you have a core that accretes more and more sort of metals and rocks and also ices. All the solid materials that are around at the point. And eventually, if it reaches a critical size, then it attracts also the gas, and then there's a big gas envelope that falls on top. So if you don't have a rocky core present today, then there is basically the question, how was the planet being formed to begin with? And sort of there's an alternative proposed by Alan Boss, who works at Carnegie, who says, I can make a planet out of, in similar like a star forms, where he has big hydrodynamic simulations that have little density instabilities. And he's saying that density instabilities can actually lead to a planet. So there's at least an alternative scenario being proposed. It's hard to test it at the moment. But if you can say something about the core, we can at least have an indication which model is preferred. So what we've done is basically we run a large number of calculations at different temperatures and different densities, and we try to characterize the interior of the planet. So we have a molecular region on the outside, and we have a transition region, and we have metallic hydrogen. And for the results that I will be presenting here, it's mainly density functional at the moment. And what we find is that we have a continuous transition from the molecular to atomic regime. So there was some controversy. How would that go about? So the simulation that we have is basically you increase your temperature, and then what would happen is if this is still molecular, this is pressure and this is temperature at constant density, and then basically at the point where you break your molecules, there's a little dip in the in pressure, you go to a negative dP dT region, but then it keeps going up. This is not a first-order transition. This is a gradual reduction. Just because the pressure goes down, because you delocalize charge, and you lead to a system that's sort of you can pack atoms better than you can pack molecules. So what we find with this method, density functional theory, The transition is continuous. There is a region of negative dP dt, but it's not first order. And what we find in addition, which I will describe in a little bit, if you add helium to the system, you're smoothing out this transition. So there's no negative dP dt region anymore if you put helium in. Because if that's sort of one, helium is sort of, this does not dissociate because it doesn't have any molecules. It basically smoothed out this transition. And otherwise, there would be consequences for the convection of this problem if you have a negative dP dt region. But helium seems to prevent that. If you compare with Soumong and Charbonnier, in the region of dissociation, we find up to 20%. This is differences to the previous equation of state, which is mainly due to the fact that their dissociation transition is just in a different place. And the results are summarized in this paper. So one of the effects that helium does, it smooths out the molecular to metallic transition, but the other effect it does, it localizes charge. If you add a little bit of helium to the system, you basically localize charge because helium has just twice as, the nuclei have twice as much charge, and therefore they localize electronic charge. And therefore they give significant room to the remaining hydrogen molecules, and therefore they're a little more stable than you would expect. So here we have a, I'm not sure you can see this too well, this is a simulation where you have molecules. So what we basically say, you have the spheres here, the electronic problem solves and leads to these charge distributions that we're showing here. So you can relatively, you should be able to see that these are molecules and the charge is localized at the molecules. And this is all run in sort of periodic boundary conditions where sort of a molecule has one part here, sort of the other part here on the other side. If you go to this other system, which is much denser, then the charge is delocalized and the molecules don't exist anymore. You have more like atoms that don't move around. If you add helium to the system, you delay the molecular to metallic transition just because you're localizing charge. That's one of the effects, one of the main effects that helium does to the system. So now we have this big set of calculations. We have pressure and temperature, and you derive an equation of state. And we give it to the planetary sort of expert, Bill Hubbard, in this case. And what he plotted here is a very mundane plot. It's basically comparing the density that we predict between the previous model of Soumong and Charbonnier. And what you find is that in the transition region, we find relatively large discrepancies. But that's not the main effect what we're after here. It's just basically because this sort of dissociation is predicted at a different point in density. But what's important is, at the high-density regime, we find that we have a different density. Our density at a given pressure is lower. So therefore, we have a correction to the equation of state of metallic hydrogen. And this is in a regime where we do not have experiments at the moment. So it's a plural theoretical prediction. And the upshot is if you are in a dense core region of the planet and you predict that the same pressure can be supported with less dense material, the upshot is that there must be something else there to make the whole mass balance right. And what we predict is that we have a rocky core in Jupiter of 15 Earth masses, which is relatively large. And not this sort of, therefore we have an updated model for the interior of this planet, and we favor with new calculations the standard core accretion model. So there is, of course, leeway to say yes or no. Alan Voss has just told me, of course, if you have a gravitational collapse and you make the planet without a core, the core could form later. There's nothing we can say. We make our contribution to this model. We're saying there should be a core here now, and the more likely scenario is core accretion. But we cannot rule this out. So then the amount of ices that are in the planet is basically pretty much close to solar. So Bill Hubbard calls this eerily canonical. So, and so that's one of the main things I would like to take away. We have new calculations, and we predict there should be a rocky core in the planet. So one more problem we're trying to address at the moment, you don't have a good answer yet, is the cooling rate of Saturn. So if we just go away, we just don't have a model for the current state of the planet, but we look how the planet cools over time. So then we can look at the effective surface temperature, as was done by Fortney and Hubbard, as a function of time. And we basically have a stopwatch, and we say when the planet Jupiter reached the current temperature as we observe today, what is the time it took to cool it to that state? And you basically get it as like 4.56 GeV, and you say, oh, that's about right. So the planet was really formed at the beginning of the solar system. The cooling models are okay, so everybody's happy. So then you do the same thing for Saturn. Run the same model with an object that's not as heavy. And you see it cools much, much more quickly. after 2 point something giga years, it has already reached its current state. You say, wow, okay, so then Saturn was formed later? Well, the answer is probably not. So there's something wrong with the model. And what was predicted by Salpeter and Stevenson, that there is an effect that's known as helium-hydrogen phase separation. And as a result, if you pressurize the mixture at the right thermodynamic conditions of high enough pressure and low enough temperature, the system would phase separate like oil and water. And there would be a latent heat release associated. And therefore, that would be sort of like add as an extra heat source to prolong the cooling. So we are after this problem. We do not have a good solution, but we have basically simulations that are accurate enough to address this issue. And so what we the best thing what we have right now, there is a region where this happens. That's as much as I can tell at the moment. We have a good method to determine this at the moment, but the results are very much in the work, and it's not what I can sort of present at this point. I did this calculation with Papenickels a couple of years ago, and what I could see is at high temperatures, up to 15,000 or 10,000 higher, then there is no phase separation. So if a heat system's up, you always mix. The question is, it has to be dense and low. But I couldn't go low enough with this method to really map out the region of demixing. So I would like to sort of switch gears a little bit and talk about extrasolar applications from more proximate modeling. And if you look at the transiting planets that we find, that were discovered so far, then we have radius and mass. And what I'm trying to say here is that I worked with Sarah Seeger on basically deriving a sort of a more generic, much more simplified equation of state models that allow us to say, what if there is a planet, a new transiting planet being discovered, can we say something about the composition of this planet? So this is just basically showing what the data that's currently available, or as of a year ago, about 10 planets, and this is sort of the mass as a function of radius, and they're all pretty much gas giants, basically, like similar planets like Jupiter. And there is a problem with this planet. For some reason, it's always bigger than current models predict. We're checking if the equation of state is responsible for this problem, but we're not there yet, and there could be many other possibilities of explaining. The contours are constant density. I think they're constant density lines. Yes, but they don't... yeah, they're lines of constant density, I believe. So, but it doesn't... But they're still, I think they're still all giant planets. There's nothing, there's no... Yeah, they're all within the range, so... Okay, so what we've done recently in a sort of in submission at APJ is we looked at different equation of state and repeated the calculation for isentropes just in a little bit simpler form for different materials. And what I'm plotting here is the radius as a function of mass. And if we look at, you can basically very well characterize what kind of planet it is. You have all the transiting giant planets that have a very large radius for a given mass. And then you have Uranus and Neptune, which has a substantial fraction of ice. And you then you have the typical sort of Earth-like planets, like this is Mars, Venus, Earth, I think. And so even from this very simple plot, you can sort of say something about this decomposition here. What we've done is very simple. We just solved the hydrostatic equilibrium, and we'll want to give it out to the observers for the next transiting planet to be discovered. Now I'm going to sort of go back to this core issue a little bit more. At the beginning, when you sort of sat down, you saw a simulation which showed one water molecule in a regime of dense hydrogen plasma. And the question is, let's go back a little bit. What happens to the ice when you form a planet? So ices are around, metals are around, and rocks are around. And when the gas envelope falls on this core, what happens? In order to address this issue, I did something very simple. The problem is to solve this directly is relatively complicated because we do not know what ice does under these conditions. So one thing I want to sort of say a little bit of about it. This should technically be a movie here, but you've probably seen the movie to begin with. So And what's happening here is you have this water molecule put in this dense hydrogen plasma, and it's actually far away from the core condition. There's only 3,000 Kelvin, and the pressure is about 13 GPa. So it's basically it's 4,000 GPa is the core position, and the temperature is like 20,000 Kelvin. So even though we're not even as hot and as dense as we would be in the core, what you're seeing here is the following. So if you watch carefully, there's just a few molecules coming, and we have sort of for temporarily three hydrogen bonds. I should probably say this. This is oxygen. These are the hydrogens. So there's many hydrogens around. What happens is under these conditions, the hydrogens get exchanged, and you do not have the covalent bonds are not stable. So the ice structure is formed by strong covalent bonds and then weak hydrogen bonds. And therefore, this explains all the possible ice structures. What this simulation shows, even if you're far away from the high and dense core regions, already under these conditions, the covalent bonds, the strong bonds in ices, are not stable. So therefore, if the planet, if the gas piles up on the surface of this planet and the pressure rises, approximately when the pressure is high enough that the innermost layer of the envelope goes metallic, then the ices become unstable. From this simple calculation, we can say the ices in the and core conditions are not the ices that we know today. It's not a proof what really happened, but the ices are unstable in the form as we know them. So there are two possible scenarios. The more likely one is when there's enough gas material there that the ices go unstable and the innermost part is metallic, then the oxygen molecules would mix in. That doesn't have to happen. I don't have proof of this. The other scenario would be that basically you have an oxygen-rich layer that forms. So I cannot distinguish, but I can say there are no ices as we know them today at core conditions. And so what I did to analyze this a little more carefully, I basically looked at the lifetime of these molecules. And so there's if you plot this as a function of pressure at the constant temperature, you see if you increase the pressure and you go more and deeper in the metallic regime, it's basically the lifetime of these objects drops quickly. So then that sort of makes them unstable. And I repeated the calculation for carbon, for CH4, which is sort of another big proponent. You have different ices. One of them is methane ice, another one is nitrogen, is ammonia ice, and they all show the very same trend. So therefore, the next big message here is we have a core inside Jupiter, but ices should not contribute as we know them at least. Okay, so the last part of the talk will be directed to the comparison with shockwave experiments. So if you, the geophysical lab is sort of famous for the static experiments, but the temperatures that can be reached at the moment are not high enough to really probe planetary interiors. Because sort of what typically happens in a static experiment is that you laser heat the system and you can reach 1,000 Kelvin, sometimes 2,000 Kelvin, but that's already a difficult experiment. So the alternative is basically use a shockwave, and that's typically done at national labs. Here, Livermore has done this for a long time. You have a gas gun here where you shoot a projectile in a small sample, and for a short amount of time you generate these extreme conditions. Then later on they have the NOVA laser, and now Sandia has sort of geared up and they use the Z machine to generate shocks. And then there's sort of NIF and the next shocks, and the first physics on NIF might actually be done next year. So the shockwave experiments are typically discussed as a Hugoniot curve. And so I'm not sure if you're familiar, but if you're shock physics, if you're astronomy, you probably know about these things. But I'm going to just briefly say what the Hugoniot curve is. Typically, you generate states as a function of pressure and density. And what happens is you have material sitting here at sort of initial thermodynamic conditions that are characterized by initial temperature, initial density, rho zero, and initial pressure. And then you have a projectile that's moving at high speed through this material. And as a result, you accumulate material in front of it. So it's just basically like shoveling snow, although you might have difficulty imagining this when you live in Santa Barbara all year round. But it's basically this dense region that you accumulate in front of this sort of shovel here. And that leads to a new thermodynamic state. It's high in temperature, high in pressure, and it can be characterized by conserving mass, momentum, and energy across this interface. It leads to these equations, and what happens in typical experiment, you start out with a density rho zero, and then you shock it to some state here. That gives you 1 point. If you then have a higher shock driver, you shock it to different density and a different pressure. And then you basically, the different points you can connect up, different points from different experiments, if you, the collection of all those final states, this is known as the Hugoniu curve. So in the whole interpretation of these shock experiments, what is the Hugoniu curve doing? There were two proposals here. One is sort of the sesame equation of state, and one was this linear mixing model by Marvin Ross. This would say that the system is much more compressible, about six-fold the initial density, while the sesame equation state would say it's only about four-fold. So this is a big, big difference. This is the whole point of making this million-dollar expensive experiment. This is hydrogen, yes. So. And this was actually done, the first data that came out was done 5 years ago. So before I kind of come back to show you the results, I'm going to say a little bit about the other techniques, which is Path and Eagle Monte Carlo, and I'm just going to say a little bit about it. It's based on Feynman's Path and Eagle method that sort of gives an expression for the thermal density matrix, which is a quantum statistics object, which you might remember from your class. It's basically an operator, and once you can characterize it, you have sort of solved the quantum mechanical problem. The efficient way of doing this is actually to represent this object in a real space in terms of a path integral, where you sort of consider the quantum fluctuations around a classical path. I'm not going to get into too many details, but it's sort of this other method. It's basically, rather than doing density functional theory, we describe the ground state. Here, you say you sort of have this thermal excitation present, and it's given by a density measure which weights different quantum mechanical states. And Feynman basically let sort of propose this efficient way of dealing with this problem. So we are. So there's two primary applications of this method. One is for bosons, and the most accurate calculations have described both the Einstein condensation in helium and given estimate of the superfluid fraction, that and of the condensate fraction as well. That is actually done with Path and Eagle Monte Carlo, and that's basically a way of here's an exact method that allows you to study an interactive quantum system. That's one of the main applications. David Zeppeli has done a lot of work on it. So the other system for fermions, you have a fermion sign problem, and you have to make an approximation, which is known as the fixed node approximation, and all the results I'll be showing use this. Basically, my contribution was sort of towards improving this approximation. So what I did during my PhD, I would basically calculate the equation of state for hydrogen using this path integral method. And then we derive this Hugoniu curve using one of the equations from the previous slide. And so this is the data point that we're, so this was these were the measurements. And that came a bit as a surprise because they favored Marvin Ross's model of a very high compressibility. While the calculations, what I did, Path-Nichols Monte Carlo, they always would favor a low compressibility, much more in line with the sesame equation state. And density functional calculations seem to be in line with this. So this scenario was basically both of these first principles calculations would not reproduce the experiment. So we were repeatedly criticized, come on guys, you have the best simulation technique. Why don't you reproduce these experimental results? And that's basically something we couldn't really do. We didn't have any knob. We could adjust, basically move the data over here. That's what I mean by first principles. I should have probably said this at some point. First principle means if you start from the mass of the electron, the charge of the electron, and from the anti-symmetric wave function, we solve this problem in this context. So there's nothing we could do, and we basically would say this is our prediction. And we actually were validated several years later after a long discussion going back and forth, and there are new experiments. One is done by Marcus Knudsen at Sandia using the Z machine, and he has generated these points. And the trend up here, he has also a point up here which I haven't put in yet, clearly show that this hydrogen is not as compressible as predicted by the early NOVA experiment.
And there's another Russian experiment using spherically converging shock waves, and this sort of gives this point here, which is also very much in line with our predictions. So therefore, it depends what side you're now talking to. I think if you talk to me, of course, I will send you the best theoretical techniques with two experiments, give you this result. If you talk to experimentalists, they say, well, we have two. I think they discard the Russian experiment because they don't know too much about it. And you have two conflicting results. So take your pick where you want to do your side. So the one thing which I did recently is the following. Rather than doing hydrogen, I did helium. And surprise, surprise, what I basically found after looking for such a long time for this highly compressible state, helium actually shows it. And the reason is now, why is hydrogen and helium, why they're so different? So this is the same diagram. It's rho over rho zero, pressure, and we have the same calculations for helium. Let me just walk you through these different sort of graphs on here. This is the path integral Monte Carlo result, which we find here. We find this huge compressibility state, and it's mainly an effect of electronic excitation. So we have density functional calculations that go up here and agree very well with other experiments down here. And then you have to include electronic excitations to go over into this regime. So if you don't do that with density function, you stay on this side. So then you cannot capture this effect. It's purely electronic that leads you to this high compression state. So this is something actually they're going to test right now. So the Livermore group is doing experiments at the moment. They're probably writing up the paper. And the initial comparison looks actually quite good for helium. So the question is now, if you believe these helium results, why are the materials so different? So this just shows what, with the Livermore gas gun, you could not see this increase. If the Z machine people are doing this, they should see it. And then with the Livermore laser data, they should also be able to see it. You basically need a strong enough shock driver to see the electronic excitations, otherwise you're not going to find it. So what I was actually, so what I basically wanted to say here is, that here we come back, here we have the deuterium experiments, or hydrogen, they're not very compressible. And for helium, we've just showed it's very much compressive. And the reason is there's a balance that comes in the equation of state that is, if you excite internal degrees of freedom, you basically go in this direction. You absorb shock energy and the system goes dense. Therefore, it drives you this way. If the system is strongly interacting, then it drives you the other way. So this maximum compression is the result of the balance of internal degrees of freedom and interaction effects. And it depends on the material where you're actually going to land. And also depends what the initial state is. And what there's an interesting development which actually working on right now is the following. It was proposed this is sort of a marriage of the two high-pressure methods that we have. They start by pre-compressing the material in a diamond anvil cell statically, and then go, let's say, to 10 GPa, or at the moment they can't do that yet, but at least to some higher compressed state, and then launch a shock into that state. And as a result, they can as a result of this pre-compression, they walk up a different Hugoniu curve than we would do it without pre-compression. And what happens is that so the prediction here, if you pre-compress more and then you plot it as a function of rho zero, then you sort of generate other families of curves. And the reason is why increase in pre-compression pushes you towards a smaller compression ratio is because the interactions do get stronger. So that is consistent between deuterium and hydrogen, but the different magnitude is just basically because helium charges more localized. The more hydrogen and hydrogen molecules are just bigger on the diagonal strong. So one more thing has been proposed with this new sort of compression technique is the following. The argument is for getting a big chunk of money. It's basically to characterize this planetary isotope more carefully. So in principle, if you go in your curve, and we'll show you in a second here, is a very steep curve. You generate the system gets very hot, the pressure rises, but you cannot reach high density states. And therefore, they say by pre-compressing, we could basically map out a larger fraction of the planetary isotope, which is true. But the question is, when I heard this, is a wonderful argument, but I just asked the question, how much? So since I have all these equation of state points, I could actually calculate it. So I would make the argument, here we have an equation, you have the first, the regular Hugoniu curve starts here at some low pressure point and then shoots up very quickly. And if you pre-compress a little bit, then you basically start at a higher pressure and it should be good up also. So you can basically map out deeper parts of the planet. And you can basically, this is sort of the surface of the planet, this is sort of the core. So you can walk towards the interior. So I'm asking the question, if the mass of the planet determines what you would like to describe, you can typically, at the moment, they can do 5 kilobar precompression or 7 kilobar precompression, which is this curve. So rather than basically characterizing this part of the curve, they can now go up to here. So this gets them a little deeper to the interior of the planet, but they can only characterize 5% of the mass because most of the planet is in a metallic hydrogen regime, and they still need a better technique of going there. So I'm not saying this to criticize their methods. Wonderful they're doing, we'll get lots of new physics out of this precompression release. But to characterize the interior, there's a lot of work for theorists to do. So I will have a job in next year, I hope. So to summarize what I've said here so far is that in the next coming years we will have a rapidly expanding set of known extrasolar planets, and we find more transit. There are several surveys being launched to look for transiting planets, and we will need ways to interpret the upcoming mass radiance relationships, and we will have examples where we can characterize the atmosphere. The new laser experiments, we will have more results for helium. I think the paper might be written already. And there will be the marriage from static and dynamic compression experiments will reach higher density regimes. And NIF will come online, will reach higher density states, much higher pressures than were previously attainable. And from a theory science point of view, we complete our equation state calculations. And they'll give out this table to the community that they can model other objects with that. And the first step will probably be calculations without electronic excitations. And the next step would be we use the path integral calculations to include the effective excitations that would basically increase the table in temperature. I'm working on doing this for helium, but then for hydrogen it will just take longer. And we will have more accurate models for extrasolar planets. And we're also working on predicting the mass radius relationships for different planets. So thank you very much. I would say I also worked on using this path integral methods for nuclear fusion in dense systems. So if someone is really eager and is learning about it, I could talk to him in private. Otherwise, in the interest of time and a soccer game, I want to finish. Thank you very much. Do you have a really burning problem you want to test right now?
Want to replace SUV?
Yeah, we're doing this. And I think if you suspect, okay. So Hubbard has the table in a moment. In a moment, they're basically you give it rather a good table out once rather than doing incremental updates. So you still have to do the low density ironing in, and you have to do high density carefully. Yes. So I think. Give us another year or something, or maybe a half a year or something. Yeah.
What are the issues
with SMA? The linear mixing is... Yeah, okay, there's two issues to this. First of all, we talk about pure hydrogen. The main correction I discerned today is actually already present in pure hydrogen. So the linear and the correction is primarily in the metallic hydrogen regime, and the reason is hard to pinpoint because they didn't run any computer simulations to do that. They relied on the Proximon models, including the OCP, and then added the electronic electron nuclear interactions. And at the ultra high density regime, this is all fine, there's no question about it. But Jupiter is dense, but not dense enough for electron ion interactions not to matter. So we have using simulations, the correction comes from that description. And to go beyond the linear mixing models, you see effects like that helium stabilizes hydrogen molecules, which is totally a non-linear mixing effect. But we have yet to see if the non-linear mixing effects will affect the interior models too much.
Is there any reason to assume any kind of separation?
Okay, so I think yes. So for the for height for Saturn, we expected there. We were working on this. So that okay, but this is yet another effect. So there's another linear mixing effect. So I think the linear mixing effects are there. We see them, but I'm not sure. I cannot say. I don't expect the static structure of the planet to change too much if you include this nonlinear mixing. But there will be quantitative effects. Yes, there will be phase separation. That is another effect. And what can I say? We're working on this. We don't have an answer. So yes, we will be trying. It depends on the concentration. I think Bill Hubbard does this relatively carefully. He looks at the available equation of state for the ices and tries to do the best. And I have some simulations running for actually looking at this problem. The deal is the concentration is low. So overall, if you have this one carbon atom in there, if you look at the chemistry, that will be interesting. But the equation of state progression will be small to the small abundance. If you look at the overall radius particle or something. Yeah, that's solar competition. The difference between solar and the planet competition is very comparable. Well, no, I wouldn't go that far. I would say what you're doing is good enough to describe the effect. Yeah. If you take it out, well, yeah. So that's what I would say. It doesn't really matter how precise you are, but you should do it. You should do something reasonable. You cannot leave it out. Yeah.
After it lasts a very long story,
so what? If you have an accurate mass, then you know, do you know the radius well enough, or? Yeah, so we could use the equation of state that we derive to sort of make an interior prediction for those objects. Yes, we can do that. So for hydrogen 1,000 grams. Let me go back here. Where are we talking about this phase diagram? Because I'm always looking at new applications for the numbers.
Of it.
Yeah, actually, so where would they be here? 1,000 grams here, and so they would. Okay, that's the core, and then they would. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's even better. I think the harder it gets, the better these techniques will work. Yes, so that would be something. So for the moment, for the Jupiter's modeling, I didn't use Pathmanical results at all. But we have those, and we can we can model this. The problem is the equation state work requires sufficient care, and we basically would focus on interesting problems. So if you can pose an interesting problem. But just for doing it, there might be a potential application 5 years down the road. That's not sufficient because but if you can sort of point out something you would like, the controversy or something that's unclear, that would be interesting. Yeah.